I found information security to be far more of an interesting proposition. I had no idea at the time the volatility of the profession and how quickly things change. Technology used to be measured in dog years. Now it's mayfly seconds, and it's hard to keep up with it. You're presented a problem, you have to solve it. Information security oftentimes presents problems that you had not experienced before and don't know how to solve. There's not a manual for it.
From Exabeam, this is the new CISO, a show about the people who lead IT security teams, the challenges they face, and how they overcome them. If you like what you hear, please rate, review, and subscribe to hear our new episodes first. I'm Steve Moore, and today I'm picking the brain of industry and Army veteran Kevin DeLange, VP and CISO of IGT. After working on nuclear missiles as a teenager and earning a degree in anthropology, Kevin took the self-described crooked path to cybersecurity leadership. 30 years later, he's sharing why his love of problem-solving led him to the role of CISO. Most up-and-coming cybersecurity professionals aspire to a long, successful career. But when you're taking the next step, what kind of experience really matters? How should you define a problem before formulating a response? And when does a CISO take on new responsibilities, or, ultimately, just let things fail? Kevin, for the uninitiated, if you would, please introduce yourself.
Sure. My name's Kevin DeLange. I'm the Global Chief Information Security Officer for IGT, which, if anybody's been into a casino, knows what IGT is, because one of the world leaders in providing not only brick-and-mortar casino slot machines, back-office systems, but also lottery, online, and instant ticket, as well as digital, in the digital space with online casinos, poker, bingo, sports betting, etc.
Now, Kevin, how long have you been at IGT?
Longer than I'd like to admit. I actually started in 1984, was gone for about 7 years, and then came back in 2003, so probably close to 30 years.
Wow. I don't think we talked earlier about what brought you back. We'll put a pin in that. I didn't realize there was a stop and go on that. 30 years, though. I will say, I feel like if you count the gray hairs in my beard, but when you were at IGT first, I was 5.
Now, thanks for reminding me of that.
Well, it goes that way sometimes. But you didn't start at IGT. When you were 17, you had probably not your first job, but kind of an interesting thing. What did you do at 17, Kevin?
Yeah, so I joined the military, was in the U.S. Army, and actually started out, that sort of was my entry point into the world of security, because I was right off the bat working on a nuclear missile site. And, you know, 18 years old, you get to dismantle nuclear warheads. It kind of sets the table for you on what is secure and what are proper processes and procedures to undertake. So it happened at a younger age. And actually, that should scare people that I was doing that at that young age. But it was a good entry point, actually.
Well, I think a couple of things there. The seriousness of process and procedure, I think there can't be understated. But I think it also, I would hope, would kind of cast the die for future behavior or expectation within your later career in security. They're saying like, hey, we got to document this and people need to be trained and this needs to be taken seriously. I mean, do you find that to be true, or was that too far in the past and not as related as I just stated?
No, I think there is a relationship because, we are who we are because it's the output of our experience in life. And when you set the stage that early in life with such a serious topic, it can't help but stay with you the rest of your life and sort of guide you around all of the obstacles that you face the rest of your life.
Now, a brief kind of sidebar on this. I was generally familiar with this, but this is kind of a nuanced element within military history. You were Army, dealing with nukes, and those were Hercules missiles. Give us 60 seconds, 45 seconds on that. How were those unique? Because they were unique.
Yeah, so late 50s, 60s, the U.S. government, obviously during the height of the Cold War, wanted tactical nuclear weapons, which Nike Hercules were, surface-to-air missiles. You know, I can't go into the specifics, I guess, of exactly how they were unique. But when you're talking about surface-to-air missiles with nuclear capability, it's different than the traditional thought of an intercontinental ballistic missile, where you have this huge silo and these huge rockets and huge missiles that can travel halfway around the world, I guess. These are really tactical. It's close-air objects, which I guess is why the military got rid of them, because the potential for harming the local population was probably as great as harming the hostile force coming in, because of the nuclear fallout that would have occurred.
I find this stuff fascinating because it's a unique kind of nuanced element of military, U.S. military history. And it's not dropping from a B-52. It's not coming out of a B-1 or a B-2 or any other large. It's not coming out of an ICBM. It is close end. You didn't say it, but I'll say it. It's would probably be a weapon of last resort, seemingly. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I would hope so.
Okay. I just found that interesting when you brought that up. I like going in. I think there are pasts, as you alluded to, kind of paint who we are in our future. So then from there, you finished up your service, and thank you for that. What came next?
So I finished up my degree, which had similar applicability to information security. I got a degree in anthropology. So I not only learned how to deal with Neanderthals properly, but again, this was a discipline that really allowed me to define a paradigm and solve an issue. So that's what security is all about, right? For the most part, you're faced with a puzzle and you have to solve that puzzle. So again, another thing that contributed to my experience in security.
I think you said it incredibly well. I actually wrote it down the first time we spoke, where I think a lot of security is just that, where it's, yeah, you use the term paradigm, you frame questions. Is this a truth or an untruth? Is this a yes or a no? And then you seek answers about that topic. And actually, this is how the concept of threat hunting actually works in a very similar way. A lot of times, it's not just, has this happened or has this not? But it's, you ask yourself a question to say, is this possible? Or does this exist? Or what is this in this frame of reference? And then you develop a theory and a hypothesis around it. And then you work to hunt towards that. And most people don't know that or miss that or get caught up in the tech. But it's incredibly relevant.
The backstory and the back sort of concepts that really elude people and is sort of looking at point that's right in front of them instead of trying to figure out how they got to that point. And I think in most cases, it's more important to understand the path there than it is to understand the problem in front of you. Because if you understand the path, you understand maybe how to put protections in place and later on to protect against similar things.
You referenced your career. The phrase you used was a crooked path, but was all based in problem solving. What did you mean by that? Or it was an earlier conversation, so you might not, but I think a crooked path is an interesting way to phrase your professional pursuits. What's that mean?
For people who have been in the business a while, have been around the block, I guess is the best way to put it, it's not a straight line, right? People coming out of university today, it's sort of you majored in computer science or you majored in computer security. And that wasn't the case back in the day. So I think most people who have been around for a while have woven their path through life to build up skill sets in different areas that ultimately led to a career in information security that there's no way you could have predicted that in the beginning once you start the journey.
I think that's absolutely the case. As you mentioned, it's a lot different because of the reasons you mentioned, where there are specific degrees. I mean, even when I was an undergrad, there was just the evolution of an undergraduate degree, some master's studies, some certificates. But I was fortunate that, A, I didn't major in security, at least in undergrad. I have graduate studies. But the better thing, I think, is that I started off in non-security disciplines, learned how to build things. And of course, then they break. How to support them, and even non-security, non-IT jobs, you know, how does the hydraulic system work? How does internal combustion systems work? How do you troubleshoot things that you can physically touch? And how does that then apply to the digital space? What's your perspective on that difference that we see today versus what I'll call from your generations to mine, that break? Do you think, do we lack something now? Do we need to add anything? Or is it better that we just get straight to the discipline and send kids out with a security degree?
I mean, there's two sides to every coin. So I guess there's some benefit that you get that background, you know, in 4 years with a degree or post degree, more years. But I don't think there's any substitution for real life experience. And as you said, having that experience around different systems, it's not that that directly applies, but the fact that you have to understand and solve problems or issues that are put in front of you in different areas, you can still apply that skill set. And if you don't have that other experience and all that you have is what you've learned in school, theoretical versus real world, I think the breadth of experience, of real world experience, lends itself when you're actually doing something and getting paid for doing that.
So kind of in that line, having someone that's been around the block, as you noted about yourself, when you're hiring, no matter the level of skill or the number of years under their belt, what are the things that you look for that may or may not surprise me? Do you have a set of questions or a formula or something that you look for in particular?
Well, I mean, you need the technical skills, obviously, because you can't come into this having grown root vegetables for the last 30 years and expect to succeed. But honestly, I look more for the soft skills. I'll let my team decide if they have the technical background to do the job I need them to do. But I'm more interested in the soft skills. And if I find somebody who is self-motivated, driven, really wants to solve problems, is interested in that, can communicate effectively, to me, that's far more important. I can always teach information security, but I can't teach people to get up every day out of bed and you know, want to stick their nose deeply into problems that other people probably wouldn't even know existed. So those soft skills for me are the most important.
So I think you covered the soft skill for sure, which I don't know that I have yet mastered, but I sure as hell didn't have it when I was younger. It was pretty rough. I was good for labor and farm labor and construction, barely suitable for work inside. But I will say that if you don't have that, the ability to communicate, even something simple, I've had staff before that wanted to spend $500,000 on a widget and could not describe the problem they were trying to solve. I find that interesting. Now, I took that as my fault, not theirs, that we hadn't talked about describing the problem well enough, which gets back to your anthropology studies. Have you encountered that?
Look, even people that experience have a problem with this. It's not, and I'm not saying I'm an expert, but I guess the best way I could describe is when you have to go in front of the board of directors or the audit committee, they're interested in getting to the issue quickly and succinctly and making sure that you've worked through whatever you're presenting to them, right? Not many people have that level of exposure and experience. So it's understandable if somebody is new, they're not going to be able to do that. But even within my team, trying to get them to simplify and decide, I guess, work at an issue backwards, right? Decide what problem you're trying to solve and then articulate why that's a problem and how you resolve that problem is probably the most difficult thing people struggle with, I guess, that I see on a regular basis. It's not that difficult, you wouldn't think in concept, but put into practice, I think, especially technical people, you really want to go down the rat hole and you know, you're speaking bits and bytes and nobody even knows, you know, what store you're in or what building you're in. It's a difficult problem, but it's an essential thing that you need to understand how to work through.
Kevin, for the listener, kind of around this idea of simplification, and you mentioned earlier about whether it's the board of directors or maybe the audit committee, can you give an example of a way you would approach that or a situation where you're taking a topic up? And I don't want you to share sort of inside baseball. That's not the goal of the question, but just sort of some virtual coaching on this to say, hey, here's a good way to present this issue or a topic for the listener that may be getting ready to do the same kind of thing.
Yeah, there's no easy answer, but the best way, I guess, to put it is that you want to speak to your audience in a manner that they can understand. So if you're speaking to a technical audience, fine, you can speak technical. They probably understand what you're talking about. But if you have to speak to people who only understand business, and this is very hard for security people to do, actually very hard for most technical people to do, But if you can't speak in business terms, then nobody is going to know what you're talking about, number one. But you're not going to garner very much support from either a financial or people perspective. And you're certainly not going to have advocates, because if nobody knows what you're talking about, it's kind of hard for them to stick their neck out and support you.
Right. Well, you mentioned having an advocate, which is important, at least having one in the room. That's typically developed in preparation prior to. Can you talk a little bit about making sure you have an advocate, and how might you?
Look, one of the most important things in this business is having advocates outside the business. A lot of that you gather through relationship that you build up over the years. So it's easier the longer you've been around and the longer you talk to people. You build up these relationships, and because you're supporting them in a certain way, they're more apt to support you. But it's equally important when you're new to either a company or program or new to the business that you find somebody that is generally interested in what you do, and then you nurture that relationship so that they will act as somebody up the food chain to sort of give you support. And it doesn't have to be necessarily support that you're even aware of. It's probably more important that behind the scenes they're giving you support to further your agenda or your goals.
I think this is especially important. And you mentioned there's a couple of reasons why. Many people in security leadership, for whatever reason, don't stay around very long. They job hop. And a friend of mine used to say, consistency wins championships, and meaning sticking around helps. And you alluded to that. You have been at your employer for a while, which helps. How do you get to that point if you're brand new? Without influence, you're going to fall flat.
Right. And that's what I was trying to say. If you're new to a job or you're new to this field, you can't sit back and expect that people are going to support you, right? This is basically my approach to life, right? I don't sit back and let life happen to me. I make life happen. And in this job, especially, you have to make it happen for you. So you have to search out these people. You look for people who have good relationships, you know, at a higher level, a senior management, whatever. And you have to take the initiative. You have to make the contact. You have to put the value proposition in front of them of why it would be good to have a good relationship with them. And I think this is salesmanship 101, right? You have to learn to sell yourself and then sell your job, what you're trying to do. It requires effort most times if you're new, but it's effort you have to put in or you're not going to be successful.
You mentioned sales. One of my favorite questions to ask if I'm in any size room, but especially a large room where I can see a show of hands, is asking CISOs how many of them have a relationship with their sales teams. Most companies that make money have a team of people that sell something. And there's typically executive leadership that's over said sales division, department, whatever. It's around 2 or 3%, if I were to give it an average, of how many CISOs have relationships with their respective sales executive leadership. And I find that astonishing. It's a little bit different than what you were referencing, but it still goes together. It's still a good advocate if you can have it, but also learning from sales 101. Do you find that strange? Is it surprising?
I absolutely do not find it amazing. I'm surprised it's 2%, to be honest with you. I don't know. My company's a little bit different, right? If you get away from the enterprise back office kind of environment and you get into what we're selling to our customers, we have various ways of doing that. And, you know, not that I'm cynical about salespeople, but right, they're going to make money, right? And it's up to us with the mechanisms that are given to us. If there's an RFP that has to go out, or you make sure you insert yourself into the contract language or whatever, even M&A activity, right? You have to be inserted into that. And I think if you're inserted into that, they get a feel for what they can and can't do from a sales perspective, right? You don't want them promising the moon that you can't deliver on. But I think it's important to understand that in most cases, when you're in this situation, the company is in this to make money. Our job is to ensure that they can make money in a secure fashion, right? So it's a necessary evil. I don't know. I hate to put it that way, but it's sales is a necessary evil. But at the end of the day, that's what's of value to the company. Getting involved with them in some way, shape, or form is paramount to make sure that whatever they sell and try to deliver is secure.
When we spoke earlier, you mentioned at one point in time you had 3 full-time jobs and you had to make a choice related to security. Take us back to that. What was going on there? And was there outside influence on that? Did you have some advice given to you to go that direction?
No advice given. To be honest with you, it was probably blind luck that I chose security. But like any company that's growing and there's not enough staff to do things, especially at that point, I was at director level. So when you're running all of the architecture and you're running all of the sort of communications area and your networks and you're running security, which was the smallest part of those 3, when I was asked to make the decision, I found security, information security, to be far more of an interesting proposition. I had no idea at the time the volatility of the profession and how quickly things change. Technology used to be measured in dog years. Now it's mayfly seconds, and it's hard to keep up with it. But that's the challenge I like, and that's the challenge I really, although I couldn't foresee the magnitude of it, I could foresee the challenge, and that's something I wanted to do, right? Again, I go back to, you're presented a problem, you have to solve it. Information security oftentimes presents problems that you had not experienced before and don't know how to solve. There's not a manual for it.
I completely agree to that. I think sometimes I wish we had a manual, only because I find a lot of teams that struggle with knowing if they're good or not. And I'm not trying to be silly. I mean, legitimately, I've had leadership from many teams say, you know what, I'm really not sure if we're doing all we should. I'm really not sure if I'm a good leader or a good CISO or what I need to be doing better, because there is no real guidebook on a lot of that. What is our definition of good? What do you think about that?
It is kind of nebulous. Absolutely. I guess the real measure is, have you had a breach lately? If you haven't had a breach, you're doing pretty good, right? That's sort of the bar I set. But again, I say that somewhat tongue in cheek, but if you, at the end of the day, speak to people at a senior level and they express appreciation for what you do, they may not know exactly what you do, but they know you're doing it. I guess that's about the extent of the feedback you're going to get, because nobody is going to say, hey, great job on those KPIs, because nobody wants to see those KPIs. Right? It's basically stuff that you use to develop your program and mature it and fine tune it. So it's, again, difficult to get appreciation and affirmation for what you're doing for people who have no idea what you do.
Yes, I completely agree to that. And when we spoke earlier, you mentioned, hey, it's hard to prove a negative, right? And oftentimes this job is thankless, and you know, you work your ass off and you can still have a negative outcome. You can still have that breach you mentioned, because it takes so much to get it right. But I wouldn't trade it for anything.
At some point, it'll get tiring, but I haven't reached that point yet.
There's a statement that I enjoy that's, you know, people don't decide their futures, they decide their habits, and those habits decide their future. Is there a habit that you have picked up in your career, in your life, that has served you exceptionally well, or a habit that you are working on to try to get better at?
Yeah, we'd be here all day talking about what I'm trying to get better at, but I think simplifying the problem is probably the most difficult thing to do and the thing I strive to do on a continuous basis. I've said it about 15 different ways already, but you really have to take a step back in this job and look at it from outside in instead of having a laser focus on inside out.
I think most would struggle with that, because they say, you know, what is, if you're looking at it from the outside in, let's pretend that's our goal, and it is outside in from a non-technical perspective, from a business unit, how are they going to know your department? What are the things they're going to see? Not much.
No, not much. Because again, to go back to what you said, it's difficult to prove a negative. I can't go to the CFO and say, wow, that $5 million you gave me really worked out well because you don't see any bad things happening. Well, what the hell kind of financial measurement is that? I mean, it's... You're not going to get that kind of, oh, good job, Kevin. Yeah, I guess you're right. But if you can, again, sort of simplify that paradigm and say, look, we've done all of these audits. We've done all these assessments. We've communicated whatever it is you're communicating is the volume and that we're faced with. And we've managed to successfully avoid anything catastrophic. That's about as simple as you can make it. And that's terms they can understand. You're never going to get to the point where they understand that you've done 800 vulnerability assessments with 10,000 vulnerabilities that hopefully were mitigated, but they will understand that an external auditor came in and gave you kudos for not only the framework you've set up, but the way you manage and the process that you manage.
Completely agree. Third-party influence is often so important. An audit can often flip upside down on you, and then people lose their bonuses and things like that. But having someone to attest that you are either mature or, more my favorite, that you have a high degree of efficacy, meaning you know how to fight, so to speak, when a problem happens, is one of my favorite things to implement. And I think having that, showing that on a curve, is very helpful for non-technical people as well, to say, hey, if I were going to chart us on CMMI, this is about where we are. Do you have similar experience or do you disagree?
No, absolutely agree. And there's two parts to that too, because especially from the board perspective, they expect to not only see an external maturity assessment of some sort or an external penetration test that couldn't get in, whatever it is, but they also want you to self-assess yourself, which I found kind of bizarre the first time I heard that articulated, but it kind of makes sense because if you're introspective and you're trying to be, you know, impartial in evaluating your capabilities and your skill sets, at least they get a sense that you're taking this seriously and you're not just sort of cruising through without any oversight.
Yeah, you're not shining them on. And I think one of the things I enjoy doing is when you evaluate yourself, it was actually a test. When we would fail, we'd actually write up the failure and articulate that. And we would write sort of findings back to ourselves and say, this is an unacceptable outcome, no matter the reason, right? This is a, you know, hey, we had a bad incident happen and we could not identify the source. We didn't have the capability to do so. We didn't have visibility, or we identified the source and then we failed, or the organization failed at coming together in a cooperative way to fix the source, which may be an IT issue or something else, right? But having that is one of the smartest things I think I did in my career or have adopted, is socialize your failures.
Yeah. I totally agree. I mean, it's easy to do root cause and lessons learned on an incident, but you have to do the same thing with your team and how you operate, because if you don't, you're not learning and you're not growing.
I asked you in an earlier conversation if there's something that CISOs shouldn't own, and we spent a fair amount of time on that. And this is one of my favorite questions, because I see CISOs owning a lot of weird stuff, and I'm okay for growth of the role. But I see some strange stuff popping up. Is there just general opinion that you have? I know you have a lot of thoughts on this, but anything high level that you think is a wrong move?
Yeah, and I guess it depends on what type of operation you have. If you're totally operational or you're totally oversight, I guess makes a difference. But what I find is, especially when you have development teams, you cannot own resolution, whether it's patching or something like that. You cannot own that. You can own the oversight of that, right? When we typically discuss information security oversight and governance, it's a three-tiered model. Information security is usually at tier two, right in the middle. Internal audit is above to keep you honest, but you have to push that responsibility to fix issues down to tier one, because you cannot possibly own everything. And that chews up a lot of oxygen in the room.
You also mentioned, we talked about like CMDB ownership. And you had a really nice statement on that, which is, if you're just doing operations, you're just an IT function, which I thought was really nice. And sort of this paradigm of risk is should be the lens, not ops. Talk to us a little bit about that. What's your stance on how you should see your security team?
Yeah. And again, it's not to denigrate operational or IT teams. They have their function and they need to do what they need to do to make the company successful as well, right? We all have our job to do. But I think small companies aside, small companies are a different model and you have to operate differently. But if you get into a larger company, or especially if you're in a multinational like I am, you absolutely cannot do everything, as we just said. And if you're doing the operations piece, and nobody else is taking ownership, then how can you have an independent lens on assessing whether the effectiveness of those controls are working or not? You can't be doing it and checking it. That's rule number one in how to fail in life, right? You can't be the one assessing whether you're doing it. So if you don't pass that off to other teams, then I don't see how you can be successful in information security, because you need to keep that disciplined oversight function. You can set up the ISMS and you can set up policies, guidelines, standards, whatever you have. But if somebody else isn't doing the groundwork and you're not assessing how well that groundwork or how well the controls are working, then you're doomed to failure, because there is no way to objectively look at that, right?
I think you framed it very well. I think if you're at a very small company, sometimes we have to wear many hats. But I think that if you're at a larger organization and you find yourself owning some of these other ops topics, you know, if you're in charge of the patching and the evaluation of the patching, you're going to get yourself caught up in a trick bag pretty quick. Because again, there's influence that has to go into this. There should be someone who owns hygiene and owns asset lists and owns code quality. And I think there's many security leaders who maybe they're too eager, maybe they're a little bit ignorant, maybe they didn't interview well, maybe there's expectations that have been applied to them as they've been there, whatever the reason, that get caught up in a no-win scenario. I see it all the time, and I hate seeing it. So I think that's why I asked the question, and I appreciate your perspective on that. I think we want to say yes, and sometimes we want to pick stuff up because no one else is doing it.
Yeah, that's the trap, right? Because I see that a lot as well. Nobody will do it. It does not mean I do it. And you have to have a lot of discipline to walk away from that. Doesn't mean you don't acknowledge it and you don't point it out to people, but you can't pick it up and own it.
No question. I had a coworker tell me once, I had just become a junior level director, and he said, "Steve, sometimes you just have to let things fail. You just have to let them melt down. You can't pick up everything in front of you that you see." And at the time I thought, oh, that's BS. Sure I can, you know, but as time went on, I realized that I needed to let those things go, to let them fail and let the outcome happen. I look back at it now and I realize I still see a lot of people doing it. And I think it can ruin a lot of security programs because it's a high friction situation.
Yeah. And you put it perfectly, because I've had this philosophy. I tell my team this all the time, that if upper management sees things going along, you pick up everything, you do everything, they don't see a problem. If it fails, they see a problem that has to be solved. But if you keep doing things yourself, then they don't view it as a problem. And why would they bother changing? Because to them, it's not a problem.
Yeah, the machine has to feel the pain.
Yeah, exactly.
That's actually a really good way of framing it, that not just letting it fail, avoiding it on purpose, letting it fail, being okay with it, maybe documenting it to say, hey, we need more help or cooperation or ownership somewhere else. But then the failure allows the visibility. I have to ask, is there what goes along with this? I think in order to say no or to let something fail, you have to draw boundaries pretty clear, I think, on your program. How do you do that? Is that within your program charters? Is that in some other sort of ownership list that you keep to say, hey, this is mine and I'm going to own it? Kevin owns this completely. Make no mistake, this is Kevin's. But this other stuff is not defined and not on my list. Do you do that, or do you make sure that your staff is sort of coached on not getting assigned goofy stuff out of meetings? Or is there some advice you have for that?
Yeah, it's kind of touchy-feely. And again, it depends on the organization and how well you can define that. But you really have to define your perimeter. And you have to understand what you will and will not do. Like, so what I'll do with business continuity may be totally different than what I'll do in patching. And what I do in patching may be totally different than what I'll do in incident response. But if you don't understand your perimeter for all of those areas, then you're going to end up owning things that you really shouldn't be owning. And once you define that perimeter, communicating that to the other business units and teams around the company, I think if you say it often enough and long enough, people understand and get the message, and you won't have that problem in the long term. But if you don't articulate it to other people, then you're going to have a pile of stinky stuff in front of you that you have to deal with.
Yeah, and it's going to distract you from your real mission, or the mission that hopefully is defined, that's important to the integrity of the company. A couple more questions for you. You talked about what you look for when you do hiring, but what advice do you have in general for those that are applying for security leadership positions? Any warning signs? Like if you had your best friend was like, hey, I'm going to go interview to be a CISO at this other company in your hometown. What are some red flags that you'd say, all right, no, don't take that. Or make sure you ask this. Or if you don't see this, like anything that pops into your mind that you've learned from experience or just through doing this a while?
Yeah, there's one criteria that I would always say, and that's you have to understand what the hiring company is defining as a CISO, right? There's CISOs and then there's CISOs. I think especially with public companies where the SEC is getting involved now, and especially from a U.S. perspective, the government's getting involved with more regulations and mandate, you sort of have to have that CISO role. But that CISO role in some companies could just be, you know, a director with not much support staff and you're doing all the grunt work. So I would definitely tell people, and that's what you like to do, unless that's really where your heart lies, then go for it. But if you're looking for something more meaningful and more impactful, I'd stay away from those kinds of jobs. And it's really easy to figure that out quickly, right?
Yeah. Where do you report? Who do you interview with when you go in the door, right? The joke I have is you don't want to make introductions in a crisis. Kevin, I can't thank you enough for your time today. I've enjoyed the chat. It's gone too quickly. I've got one final question that I ask everyone, pursuant to the name of the show, the new CISO. What does being a new or maybe not so new CISO mean to you, Kevin?
I think it's an amalgamation of probably everything we talked about today, right? It's keep it simple, understand what the role is, and be able to communicate. That's about as simplified as I can make it. It's not that difficult to understand what the role should be. It's probably a lot more difficult to execute on that. But if you keep it simple, I think it's easier to manage.
Yeah. Kevin, you're a gem. Thank you so much for being on the show.
I appreciate talking to you. Thank you.
That's it for this episode of the new CISO. Thank you for listening. Check out more episodes on exabeam.com/podcast. And remember to rate, review, and subscribe to get brand new episodes first.